Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Columbus's on-again, off-again relationship with passenger rail of any stripe dates back to the 1970s. Since then, the city has seen a slew of proposals for some type of fixed rail transportation. Former Mayor Michael Coleman was among the most enthusiastic proponents, but all have failed. Last month, Columbus City Council President Zach Klein told Columbus Business First that the time had come to revisit the issue.
But on the trainability, mass transit side, we're clearly lacking. We don't have those options here. So it's time for us as a community to sit down and talk about what that means for the city, how much that costs as a city, and after state and federal folks hopefully pitch in, which I don't think it exists if they don't pitch in, what the final price tag is. And then we need to ask everyone in the community, are you ready to open your pocket to make this happen for the city of Columbus, or is it more just lip service and something that's more aspirational?
Joining us now to talk about that, public policy reporter for Columbus Business First, Tom Knox. Welcome to the show, Tom.
Thank you for having me.
Zach Klein was unable to join us today, but one of his aides said that the references to rail were blown out of proportion in your article. I listened to the entire interview, but I'm interested in your take on the conversation. How did the issue arise in the first place?
Well, I take issue with them saying that it was blown out of proportion. If you listen to the interview, which we have on our website, we simply asked him about the population growing, projected to grow by 500,000 by 2050, and said, you know, what issues do you see coming up from that? And Zach Klein first brought up mass transit. I mean, we need a way to maybe move all these people around. So that's how the conversation came up. He brought it up first. We subsequently asked multiple follow-ups because, you know, this is was and has been a big issue, but it hasn't gotten very far. So for the council president to say we need to bring this up and we need to sort of not just pay lip service to this anymore, we thought was warranted a good story.
Nothing is in the works in terms of any kind of passenger rail or streetcars in the city of Columbus, right?
Right. And that's what he said, isn't, you know, nothing's in the works, but we need to actually see if we should do something, if something should be in the works for this. You know, we've done studies, not Business First, but the city has done studies, you know, but nothing's really gone past very preliminary stages.
When's the last time? I think it was it Michael Coleman?
Yeah.
Who suggested
he had a
cars.
Task force.
Right. Mm-hmm. And what happened then?
I think it just was, you know, panels, presentations, but I don't think it really got much farther than that.
What have been the objections to light rail, or let's talk about streetcars, for instance, in Columbus? Who objects to the idea and why?
I think the main objection is, like it is in any city that talks about this, it's cost. How much is it going to cost? Will the cost be worth it for how many people might end up using this? Who's going to pay for it? I mean, these are all things that the president brought up as well. Who's going to pay for it? Where's it going to go? And, but yeah, cost is always the big thing for this. I mean, we spend a lot of money redoing our roads, which everyone pretty much uses our roads. But the argument is, well,
we have to use the roads.
Right. The argument is, well, I'm not going to use light rail. Why would I pay for this?
Mm-hmm. And when he talks about, he made a big point in his comment there that we heard about, we're going to have to think about, are we ready to pony up, basically? Mm-hmm. Are we ready to start paying for this? We're going to have a lot to pay for. There might be a little state, there might be this and that, federal money, but all things being equal, we have to think about it as a local.
Right. And he mentioned, you know, eventually maybe we'll get neighboring cities involved, you know, depending on where this goes, but he talked about the sort of famed Columbus cooperation and working together. I don't know if that would include a business that would be, you know, a nationwide or somebody that would put some funding down. But mm-hmm. ultimately, it is going to be Columbus taxpayers that would pay for anything like this.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the possibility for passenger rail of some stripe or another in the city of Columbus in central Ohio. The topic was triggered by comments made by Columbus City Council President Zach Klein recently to Columbus Business First. Still with us is Tom Knox. He's a reporter for Columbus Business First and wrote about Zach Klein's comments regarding passenger rail. Joining us now is Chad Gibson. He's a lecturer in the Knowlton School of Architecture at Ohio State University. He's a senior planning officer for the city of Upper Arlington. Washington as well. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
You led a group of undergraduates at Ohio State as part of a studio course dedicated to studying mass transit options in Columbus. First of all, can you just tell us what are the options out there?
Sure. The students had a client that semester, which was one of the task force part of the JET task force, the working group, the transportation working group. And what they did was look at the best options for location of a light rail system or line or lines. And what they came up with after looking at coder ridership data was High Street and Broad Street were one and two.
No duh.
You talk about housing density and ridership data. So they extrapolated that and they looked at those two areas and then a third segment from Broad Street to get you to the airport.
All things being equal, what sort of tipping point are we looking for when it comes to a city like Columbus and a need for more of a mass transit other than bus?
Well, I think traffic is the key component. Right now, we enjoy a pretty nice roadway system. And as mentioned earlier, we're looking at another 500,000 people in the area in the next 35 years. So our traffic conditions are not going to improve. We don't seem to blink an eye at spending $1 billion plus on the I-70-71 split, but we could spend potentially less than that with federal and state funding to get in a light rail line, which will take pressure off of those freeways.
And what's a light rail line? What does that even mean?
It just means a system of fixed rail transit that, of course, people would pay a fare to use, and it's not like a bus system like we currently have with COTA.
So what does it look like? I mean, is it – I'm trying to figure out how to describe it to people because a lot of times when we talk about streetcars, people think we're talking about Rice-A-Roni trolley cars from San Francisco. We're not. When we talk about light rail, does it look like a train? What is it – how does it work?
Sure. I mean, you've got lots of different variations, and the program or the plan that the students came up with goes through all the different variations of rail.
And the options and what they would cost and how they would work.
Absolutely. And it even has a design function. It's called ColumbusRail.today, where you can go and actually design your own train based on the factors that you think should be included.
And when we talk about 500,000 more people, which puts us about 1.5 million, at least for the metro area, right, Tom Knox?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, by 2050. When you talk about building a light rail line that would serve a city that size by 2050, what are the planning components to that? How much time does it take to do something like that?
I could take upwards of a decade from start to finish. I mean, there's environmental concerns. You have to make sure you have enough right-of-way, enough power. There's sometimes acquisition of different properties for stations, et cetera. You have to make sure you're in line with the funding opportunities that are there. It depends on sometimes the political environment as well as, you know, whether or not we have a champion in the area to help us get to the finish line with a project of that scale.
Is there typically a champion involved?
There has to be. You've got to have community support and rallying of support for this to get done.
Yeah. And some people thought that Columbus Mayor Michael Coleman was going to be that person, but no, it wasn't.
Yeah, I mean, I guess there's only so much the mayor could do, even somebody as popular as Mayor Coleman was. I don't know if we may need one of our large businesses.
You mentioned
to step
Nationwide,
in. Yeah.
Like they did with the arena downtown.
Right. AEP does a lot of community things as well. So, yeah, maybe that's what we need to push this further. But
what is the cachet? We heard a quote at the top of the hour, Governor Kasich back in 2010 when he rejected the $400 million from the federal government for startup seed money, I guess, for high-speed rail in the state of Ohio. He said there's a rail cult. It's a cult of people, and he seemed – that's a very dismissive way of addressing people who are proponents of rail. But what is the cachet? I mean, economic reasons to support it?
No question about it. Transit-oriented design is what we call it. And so there is a domino effect of installing a light rail station where people want to invest in that immediate area.
Because it's fixed.
Because it's a fixed rail system. It's not going to go anywhere. So you have a major, major economic impact in a positive way towards the land use values around stations where people can easily walk to transit.
you know that's where it's going to be. You don't just lightly switch it around like you do, say, and I'm not saying COTA lightly switches around their bus stops, God forbid.
Right.
But, you know, that it's not, it can't be switched.
That's right.
Tom Knox, this is what you're going to be covering going forward.
Right.
Have you looked at other cities and how and their trajectories, their journeys to major public transit like a light rail or streetcars?
I haven't looked in depth. I did look briefly at Minneapolis, which has one. And there's appears to be doing well from what I read from the Minneapolis Star Tribune. They just mentioned, you know, they've actually had more riders than they expected. Now, Columbus is not the same as Minneapolis, but I haven't gone too far into looking mm-hmm. at other cities, but I'm sure there are sort of pros and cons for both.
And that High Street Broadway or Broad Street intersection, that's very helpful to a city like Columbus.
Absolutely.
When it comes to the costs and the way to approach building a system.
No question about it. That's our bones of our community, those two axes. So those locations were not a surprise to me once the students got into the details and the research on where it made the most sense to put our first line or two.
And then the arguments about where to put money like this, it's often compared to we don't want to spend money on stuff like that. I think Governor Kasich, or he was then governor-elect at the time in 2010, one of the suggestions he had was use it to reduce the federal deficit, use it on other things besides rails. It's really not like that when you talk about transportation money, right? It's not like you can just use it on something else.
Right.
It comes from a certain pile of money, and at least at the federal level.
Right. So I think most of these other projects in other cities you know, they're not entirely funded by whatever city they're in.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that federal or state money is going to fund the majority of the project. I think if this goes any further, it's going to be mostly from Columbus.
And Chad Gibson, where does money come for this kind of stuff?
There are a variety of different transportation grants at the state and federal and local levels that we could seek out. The students presented to this task force that was mainly staffed by MORPC, the Mid-Ohio Regional Planning Commission.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of their jobs is to look at our region as a whole and discuss improvements moving forward. So
we weren't able to get anyone from MORPC on the show. They just weren't able to attend it. But in general, I mean, they do have to look at 2050. They do have to look ahead. That's kind of what they do. What's your sense about whether or not mass transit, the likes of passenger rail or streetcars, is part of that plan?
Well, you've got organizations like COTA doing their next gen plan, which, you know, they're doing outreach right now, and they're getting feedback from stakeholders and people that live in this area, whether or not they think light rail should be a part of their overall system. COTA's not going away anytime soon. They do a great job in moving people around the community. They just did a transit system review, and they're implementing all those changes now, and it's an improved system. And so I think moving forward, MORPC has done an excellent job at looking at these big picture issues and bringing all the different municipalities together at the table so we can solve these big problems.
Right. COTA's not opposed to this idea or this concept. It's not an either-or proposition.
That's right.
Right.
Light rail is a component of transit.
It's the Central Ohio Transit Authority.
That's right.
A component.
We're not going to be doing away with buses anytime soon. This is just a component of the overall system.
Well, I want to say thanks to Tom Knox for joining us today. I appreciate your participation.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Tom Knox, he's a reporter for Columbus Business First. We'll have a link to his story on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. We'll continue our conversation about the possibility, the potential for mass transit other than bus in Central Ohio. So stay with us and let us know what you think. 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@WOSU.org. You can check out our Facebook page and post a question or comment there. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. City Council President Zach Klein recently said that one of the chief issues Columbus will face looking forward to 2050, as it keeps growing in that direction, is transportation. And that conversation, conversations about light rail and mass transit other than bus are ready to occur. We just heard from Tom Knox, public policy reporter for Columbus Business First, who interviewed Zach Klein and whose interview you can check out on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Still with us from the Knowlton School of Architecture at Ohio State University. He's also a senior planning officer for the city of Upper Arlington. Chad Gibson, thanks for joining us again, Chad.
Thanks for having me.
And joining us now is policy analyst at the Buckeye Institute, Greg Lawson. Welcome back, Greg.
Always good to be here.
So the Buckeye Institute in general opposes subsidizing a light rail line or light rail in general. It would obviously cost government dollars to do that. Is it just now that Buckeye Institute opposes it, or looking forward, 500,000 new people in Columbus and in central Ohio in 2050 then too?
I think we're very – and to clarify, we are generally skeptical. So I think that's absolutely
much correct. Better word, right?
I mean, there could in theory be a situation where – if you were to get the right kind of return on the investment, in theory, maybe you could justify that. Certainly, we already have public transportation, even in central Ohio, with respect to obviously COTA and the bus service and stuff. Mm-hmm. So we think that. But one of the challenges of light rail is it appropriate for different locations? Now, I know Columbus and sort of the central Ohio area is, relative to a lot of other cities of similar population size, doesn't have one. Many of them do. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you also have to look at population density and a whole variety of different factors. Now, we are going to see more people growing. We're one of the meccas of growth, really, in the state of Ohio.
And an increase in density as well. People seem to be wanting to live closer together.
And there is an awful lot of that. But I also think that we've seen a lot of studies from a lot of different organizations that raise questions about some of the assumptions that we have about the benefits of this. You have situations where, you know, we have to see some modifications to how people want to use their automobiles. You know, if you get more gridlock and you have a situation where as the population increases and this becomes more and more problematic, I think you'll see public attitudes perhaps shift a little bit, and there might be more willingness to put in the public resources.
Well, what we've done in the past in central Ohio is just build more lanes and an outer belt, you know, an outer belt. It used to be the outer belt was through 50. Or, you know, there used to be an inner outer belt, now there's an outer belt. That's what we've done. I mean, why not just build more streets?
Well, and I think this is one of the big issues that we have to address with light rail is, what is the nature of – what's the size of it going to be? How broad is it going to be? I mean, you've got the High Street to Broad Street kind of corridor we're talking about. I mean, also, do you go to the airport? Do you have situations like that occur? What are the costs for all of that versus what are the costs for the highways, and how much does that relieve congestion over time for the transportation of goods and people and stuff? And I think that you know, it's – the big thing is people like vehicles. They like the freedom that's attached to vehicles. And yes, millennials and some younger folks like that compactness and being in an urban area. But is there enough of them? And will there be enough of them?
Well, there's more of them than there are of us now, Greg.
Oh, no. And they may be moving in. And as Ohio State goes, and if central Ohio continues to grow, you may see that they're willing to do that. But I think that we have to be honest about, A, the costs, because it is an extraordinarily expensive upfront cost.
It is. And let me ask you about a phrase you used, return on investment. Mm-hmm. How does that apply to public transportation?
Well, I think what you have to have is you have to say, first of all, with a big investment like that, you have to be sure that you're going to have something that enough people are going to use, that when you do the operations, you're not constantly having to perpetually subsidize the operations. It's one thing to do capital and the investments and the construction. One of the problems that you could envision is, do you have enough people actually getting on? And I think that gets to the question of, what do people want? What do people expect? How many people are going to do this? And we sort of have this assumption that everybody's going to want to go, and maybe because it's compact, they want to do that. But if enough people live in a compact area, you've got the bicycle lanes, you've got that, you do have the buses, and, you know, you've got things now like Uber and Lyft, and eventually, in the maybe not so distant future, you're going to literally have driverless cars. You know, Google's already doing that. Now, it sounds sci-fi today, But in 5 to 10 years, and certainly in 10 years, that might not be so sci-fi. So when you're talking about probably over $1 billion at least combined funding from the different streams, mm-hmm. is that what people are going to want? Or what if they can read a book while they're having their driverless car take them down and they don't mind that and you build the extra lanes that you were talking about?
But even with driverless cars, even if we go that route, there's still the ancillary costs of air pollution, that kind of thing. Now, it might be sci-fi too in the future that maybe we won't have,
you might have
carbon dioxide
gas,
emissions and that kind of a thing, but that seems really sci-fi more than self-driving cars at this point. They haven't been able to figure that one out. So without subsidization, talk about the notion, though, of the fixed rail line and the impact on the economy that way, because we found in lots of cities there's a premium to being located, if you're a retail outlet, a premium to being located near a fixed rail line, a fixed light rail line or a streetcar line, that you pay a premium for that and you help subsidize the cost of it.
Well, and I think this also gets to the point of how things get structured and what does the private sector do. I heard Mr. Knox earlier talking about what does the private sector put in, what kind of skin do they put in mm-hmm. to the game, because it benefits them ultimately too.
Right.
It benefits the community,
like
for the workers.
Arena downtown, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. And I think that raises another question of what's the capital investments there. I would say that we've always been very skeptical of things where the public sector puts in all the money and the private sector kind of reaps all the rewards on it, where, we don't like tax subsidies. We mm-hmm. don't like tax breaks for particular businesses. And this isn't exactly the same thing, obviously, but if you have a heavily subsidized project, and that is your idea for economic resources, well, those tax revenues are coming out of somebody's pocket that they could be investing in a different way, in some other way that could also have economic development. So I don't know. Yes, there can be clustering and there can be things like that that can be beneficial, but we also have to wonder, are there diffuse costs associated with redirecting those resources, and were those resources ultimately deployed in a way that makes the most sense? And I think those are the kind of questions that you really have to analyze. It's conceivable that that could occur, but I think that there's oftentimes a rush to assume that it's always going to turn out
positively.
Well, there
hasn't been much of a rush in central Ohio to assume
any
such thing.
Pops up every 10 years,
yeah,
I think.
Exactly. It's a cyclical thing here. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the prospects, the potential, the pros and the cons of mass transit besides bus in central Ohio. Obviously, we see things now, transportation systems, there's so much more to it than we even envisioned 20 or 25 years ago. As my guest, Greg Lawson from the Buckeye Institute, suggested, there's Uber. There's different ways. We can rent a bike. We can rent a smart car. We can all get around in lots of different ways. And Chad Gibson at the Knowlton School of Architecture, you've had to add these factors in as well, things you didn't conceive maybe back when you were first studying.
Absolutely. One of the things that the students did was they looked at case studies from all over the country, and they identified successful attributes of mass transit, and they also identified major setbacks and major errors that communities or cities made.
Such as the Detroit People Mover or something like that?
Yeah, the ColumbusRail.today outlines all of those different positive and negative factors, but when you're spending that kind of money, you've got to get into the detail and know that it is going to be successful. And that's why we focused on ridership and density and whether or not there would be enough ridership to support such a system.
And what is that equation like?
Well, it involves extrapolating data from other systems, really. And that's what we did. We looked at all those other systems and how many people live within a certain distance of those lines, and as well as the ridership from our existing transit system.
And a lot of that presupposes or depends on the fact that millennials will be the majority, and really, well, they already are. There's more of them than there are of baby boomers now. They tend to support it. They're changing. I mean, just what people like to do is changing.
Well, one thing, though, to also I think be a little careful on is I think that it also depends on where people are at in their life cycle.
Mm-hmm.
Millennials, when they're, when you're first out of school and when you're first becoming professional,
they
when you're dating,
they want to live downtown.
They say they want to live downtown. And actually, they do a lot of times. But when you start having kids, this gets into education and a lot of other things, but they move out. I mean, I lived in Columbus up until a year and a half ago. I loved the area I lived. It was was walkable. It was friendly. There were great bars, great entertainment. My wife and I made a decision. We've moved out to Westerville now. Some of that was an education decision, and some of the walkability, just different traffic patterns and mm-hmm. things like that with kids. But I guess that I don't think we're an anomaly in that sense. I think that's a very common thing. So, are you going to, what happens when you have a bulge that maybe uses it for a temporary period of time, but you have this big capital investment, and then as that bulge shifts, what are we going to have in terms of demographics to continue that ongoing thing? I think that's another issue. So because if people move out to the suburbs, I don't know. I mean, maybe you create lines out to some of the suburbs.
Well, yeah, and you also retrain how people think about transportation too, I think. I mean, is that part of it eventually, Chad?
Well, I think for this sort of a system to be successful, we can't just have millennials riding it.
Yes.
We've got to have people using the system all across the board.
What about older people who can't drive anymore?
Absolutely.
Or people who are disabled?
There's a significant cost of owning and maintaining a vehicle and parking. And so a lot of it comes down to personal economics, whether or not you're going to use this system or not.
Mm-hmm. Let's take some calls. I want to grab Jeff in Columbus. You're on the air. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. Sometimes it feels on transportation policies that our governor's leading us boldly into the 1950s. Other states certainly were happy to take Ohio's money and use it on their rail systems. But the governor's rejection was based on a false premise. It never was proposed as funding for high-speed rail. So I wish one of your guests could please explain the difference between high-speed rail, conventional rail, and then light rail or
okay.
light transit, because nobody seems to get this straight.
Well, that's a good question, Jeff. And I think the confusion arose from that it was seed money to start a system that eventually could lead to high-speed rail. Chad Gibson, am I right? Do you remember back then in 2010?
Sure. Definitely remembers a lot of those discussions.
Because everyone said that 60 miles an hour is not high speed.
Right. And it didn't make sense in a lot of ways because I'm not going to pay money if I'm going to get there slower. I got to know that I'm going to get there faster than if I'm in my car.
But isn't that a false premise? I mean, isn't a lot for a lot of people? No, I don't need to get there faster, but I need to get there and be able to read a book while I'm going there.
Convenience is key.
You
got to have the right number of trains. It's got to be when you need them. And
right.
it's got to be as fast or at least reasonably as fast as what you could do in a car.
Yeah. And Greg Lawson, that's something that you're suggesting is not clear would occur.
Sure. And I think that's interestingly enough, if you had, it's very in Asia and things, you see an awful lot of the bullet trains and the high speed. I mean, we're talking hundreds,
really
150, 180 miles an hour and things like that in Japan and things. But we don't have anything like that yet in America. Now, if you were doing cross country, I mean, you have Amtrak and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But if you had something like that, that was truly high speed and you could move across the country and it was easier than air flight.
Mm-hmm.
There may be a larger conversation there. We haven't moved to that position yet. I think the challenge with what the governor did was it was seed money. I think there was a lot of discussion of what it was going to be, the three C's, Columbus, Cincinnati, and Cleveland being connected kind of in that thing. So it's almost like an alternative to 71 or something like that. And I think he thought that didn't make a lot of sense. We thought that was a wise decision that the governor mm-hmm. actually did return that because, again, it's the amount of volume that you can get on something like that and doesn't make sense to do that. And so light rail, obviously a lot different because that's a much more localized type of rail system, much more like the metros and things like that you get in like New York, D.C., whatever.
Yeah, and, sure. Chad Gibson.
With regard to your previous caller, I would really encourage him to go to this columbusrail.today site because it gives a really, really nice explanation of each type of rail and what the system involves.
Yeah, we'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Jeff, thanks for that call. Now I want to turn to Dave in Columbus. Hi, Dave, you're on the air.
Yeah, it's been quite clear that the cost of this is going to be on the backs of the taxpayers. And I just think that if you're going to spend the money, Columbus schools sure need a lot of help, and spending it to make it more convenient to travel or educating our children, the education is far more valuable to Columbus.
All right, Dave. I mean, that's a good point, except that it's not exactly an either-or proposition. Is it, Greg Lawson? I mean, from where you sit, even though you're skeptical?
It's not exactly an either or. I do think
there is funding that can come from the federal government
for
this, just like we have for roads.
Right. There is funding that can come there. That said, though, there will be I don't think it's exactly an either or and that it can be completely looked at that way. But it is somewhat fair to say that we have to look at the totality of the resources. And when you are talking about income taxes, I mean, whatever the revenue or a fee or I mean, CODA gets obviously a sales tax piece from the entire from Franklin mm-hmm. County and all of that. You do some of that's inevitably going to be a portion of this. And so priorities are important and what is going to get you the most bang for the buck. Now, we generally don't think that the government can make the best investment because it tends to think this is what the best thing is today. You know, I was just talking to
Where do private interests have an interest in planning ahead to 2050 when there's going to be 500,000 more people here? I mean, what private interest cares that much?
Well, no, I mean,
they've got shareholders.
They do have shareholders, and you do have a challenge associated with that because they have to make those kind of shorter term decisions.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the problem oftentimes is we have an assumption that we know what the future is going to look like, and it rarely conforms to what we previously think. And so we're always constantly surprised by where things are going.
Yeah, but we have to plan.
We do. But again, I think that
it costs money.
It costs an awful lot of money to build this, and it would cost money to build bigger roads.
Yeah.
But until we have these fundamental shifts across all the populations that you can guarantee, and some of it will happen with the millennials. There is some of that. Some of that, though, again, might be time limited because of things. It's kind of presumptuous, I think, okay. Sometimes to assume this when in 10 years if people are like, hey, I want to just take my electric car, for example, mm-hmm. electric driverless car. And again, I know it's sci-fi and I don't want to be too far out there, but it's
talk about it all the time.
But it could happen. And if people are choosing that, mm-hmm. it's not clear that light rail, you don't want this big asset you just spent $1 billion+ on in combined funds. And even though you might get federal dollars, we have to be very careful to understand federal dollars aren't free. They're either federal tax dollars or it's debt
money.
But
money that we're already putting into it, we get sure. money and that's what builds a lot of our highways or at least the big chunks
with
of
the gas tax and things
right,
like that.
Exactly.
But the gas tax
will go down if more people are using mass transit.
Well, yeah, and then you've got an issue there. And then what do you do with the highways? Right. And now we're going to have a conversation about the gas tax at some point.
The question is
when you divert money from the gas tax uh-huh. to pay for transportation, like light rail or something, but if you're diverting some of that.
But the gas tax is supposed to go to transportation. That's a transportation budget.
It's mostly to go to the highways. And I think that there's a major debate. People don't like, some people are okay with it and some people aren't. I would say more on a more free market.
It's supposed to go to the highways because it goes to airports too. And
there is a lot of discussion about whether or not some of the diversions of the federal gas tax to other non-highway oriented things is exactly the way that it was designed.
Isn't the logic behind that though, and correct me if I'm wrong, but that, you know, the longer we can preserve our highways, the better. The less money we have to put into them to upkeep them, mm-hmm. take care of them, the better. And we do that by having better other options like air, like train, and that kind of a thing. And it takes the wear and tear off the roads.
Well, there's also the conversation about what are the right fee-based situations.
Uh-huh.
If you have fees that are associated, so, you know, obviously with Amtrak, you have some mm-hmm. subsidy. Theoretically, you should have the amount of volume of people using it mm-hmm. should pay for itself. And I think that there is now, obviously, there is going to be some seed money for things like airports. And there has been that
yeah.
as well, for sure. But you want it to be as self-sustaining as possible with respect mm-hmm. to people making user fees.
And therein lies the issue, and so
the gas tax is a user fee on people who are choosing to use the highways because they're using gas in their vehicles that they're then using on the things.
Or some people are waiting to talk to us on the phone saying we're forced to use the highways. We have to do it. Chad Gibson, go ahead.
Just a quick comment. I recall that Denver, Colorado was a shining example of a public-private partnership where a significant portion of the cost of their system was deferred or defrayed by private entities that did make investments in transit-oriented stops and things like that. So it's not going to solely be taxpayer money. There are
mm-hmm.
lots of
right.
options for other funding sources.
Right. Okay. Let's see. We've run out of time with Greg Lawson. Thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it, Greg.
Absolutely. Glad to always be here.
Greg Lawson, he's policy analyst at the Buckeye Institute, which is skeptical of mass transit that includes high-speed rail or streetcars in Columbus and in central Ohio. Still with us, Chad Gibson from the Knowlton School of Architecture at OSU. He's also a planning officer for the city of Upper Arlington. We'll get to some calls, and we'll hear more when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. We're talking about whether or when Columbus might be ready for passenger rail of some type. Maybe it's a fixed streetcar line. Maybe it's a light rail to the airport. Maybe it's a north-south corridor, an east-west corridor. What do we know? Still with us from the Knowlton School of Architecture at OSU and Senior Planning Officer for the City of Upper Arlington is Chad Gibson. Thanks again, Chad, for joining us.
Happy to be here.
And joining us now is Vice Chair of Transit Columbus. That's a pro-passenger rail organization, Josh Lapp. Welcome to the show.
Very excited to be here, Ann.
Columbus is one of the largest cities that lacks a commuter rail system of any type. You just heard from Greg Lawson from the Buckeye Institute saying it just hasn't made sense up to this point. We're different.
I would say we disagree as an organization. If you look at cities like Salt Lake City, Phoenix, Houston, Charlotte, all these cities
are very sprawling.
Yeah, sprawling. Some of them are smaller than Columbus. We certainly have the ability to do that. We think we have the public support to do that. We have the density to do that. So we think that we're ready.
We've talked a lot about the issue of public-private partnerships and that there probably has to be a private component to this, like the arena downtown or that
Absolutely.
Sort of a thing.
I think there's great examples of that working around the country in Maryland on their Purple Line. In Denver, they were able to massively expand their system because they were able to do a public-private partnership, and Columbus is lauded for that. So I think that would be a good opportunity.
How did they do it? What did it look like?
I don't know exactly all the details, but they did sort of – part of it was the private partners financing the project.
Okay.
So, because they had more financing, they were able to do a larger amount.
They didn't have to sell bonds then, that kind of a thing?
Like I said, I don't know all the details, but I know that that was a huge component to their system and others around the country. So I think that we've done it well on other projects on the side of Greenways and the Arena District and some other places around town. So I think that would be a good opportunity for the city as well.
How far, Chad Gibson, do we know that people are willing to walk to get to something like light rail? The one I've been on recently was in Charlotte, that rail system. And you do have to drive, for a lot of people, have to drive to get to it.
Right. There is some guidelines involved. I mean, most folks, depending on what kind of climate that you're in, there's a little bit of a variation, but you're thinking about a half mile, a mile where you would walk without driving your car. There's that balance of time versus convenience.
Right.
Is it going to be quicker and cheaper for me to get to my destination, or is it just a wash?
Let's see. Sorry, Mort in Westerville, you're on the air. Hi, Mort.
Hi. Back in the 90s when I had my office at Crosswoods, I was very enthusiastic about the proposal to buy the lines from there to downtown, and COTA foolishly rejected it. Is anybody looking at sharing the rails now? I know they're busy now.
Right. They're very busy. Freight traffic has increased exponentially in the United States, and just in the last 20 years, how does that play into these larger questions, Chad?
That's a great question. I know COTA has a park and ride at Crosswoods that's located directly adjacent to a freight rail line, and so there are certainly pinch points with regard to freight in the Columbus area that will have to be worked out if we're going to share those lines. We have to be proactive and work with those rail companies to make it make sense for them to share those lines.
Is sharing those lines the only conceivable way of getting light rail into the area?
It is not.
Okay.
It's certainly not. You can build that new infrastructure, but it only makes sense to at least look at sharing infrastructure if it's already in place.
What do you say about that, Josh?
I think the most important thing is that we have a successful first rail line. So I think that it should be a data-driven solution. So we should use the data to say, where is it going to work best? COTA's already doing that with their next-gen plan. They're trying to figure out, what are the outlines for that kind of system. And so it really, if it works best on a freight rail, okay, let's figure that out. If it works best, running down a street, then maybe that's the best solution.
Being a streetcar type of solution
or a mix of all of the above.
Whatever.
Uh-huh. Yeah, but I think the best would be if a data-driven success.
Thanks a lot, Mort, for that call. Dan in Clintonville, you're on the air. Hi, Dan.
Dan?
Yep.
Hi, you should call your show Streetcar Named Desire. or desire for streetcars.
I just need you to write my headlines for me, Dan.
Play some Johnny Cash, too.
Right.
This harmonizes with Mort a little bit. Does anybody know about that existing rail bed that was there up until recently that ran through Westerville and then it runs south between Cleveland Avenue and Westerville Road? The bed's still there, but the rails are gone.
Hmm. Are they turning that into a bike path or anything? Or
I think
part of it's a bike path, but that really harmonizes with the last two discussions.
Yeah, yeah, it's a good point.
Yeah.
We have turned a lot of rails into trails in Central Ohio and really across the state. Is there a conflict there?
In other communities that have built light rail lines, they have done it alongside some bike paths in certain instances.
Okay,
so you know it's not inconceivable that that would happen.
And we do actually have some infrastructure already in place. If you drive out to the airport, the new tarmac bridges over International Gateway were built with an extra width to accommodate light rail. So we're already thinking into the future that this is going to be a reality.
And what about the bridge over 270 in Worthington that they've redone and they're redoing? Has that been built to – that's High Street. That's 23.
The students looked at a number of potential
those projects out there?
Issues,
yeah.
Yes. And, for example, even the cap over 670, it was determined that that was not built to accommodate light rail.
Okay.
And so you have to factor in additional monies to retrofit those bridges in those various circumstances that will require additional infrastructure.
Okay. And Josh Lapp, do you have any sense about how transportation planners are – even conceiving the possibility of this in the future when you're talking about 23 and Broad Street?
Yeah, I know if you look at what they're doing right now with Connect Columbus and NextGen, both like 30 to 50 year planning operations, they even are looking at that line in Westerville that the caller was talking about. They're looking at just what is the feasibility for these and what would work best. So I don't know how specific they're getting into the actual infrastructure, but I think just a general outline of where we want to put it and the money will follow that.
Okay. Dan, thanks a lot for that call. Letty in Cincinnati, you're on the air. Hi, Letty.
Hey, how are you guys doing? I really appreciate your collaborating on this topic. It shows leadership. And what the world needs now is a good show of leadership. I believe that collaboration is the answer, is the medicine that we need in order to make things better. Thank you for accepting my call.
Sure.
I'm just wondering if your interviewees, any of them have read the University of Cincinnati's DAP program, put together a proposal for light rail that the city of Cincinnati turned down, and I cannot understand it because it came with all the bells and whistles that resulted in saving money. You know, they saved a lot of money in their proposal. They got the best product and the best skills, you know, the best, maintenance people or construction people. They got all the prices down real low. And I'm just wondering if you guys are collaborating with any universities in the state of Ohio and seeing what the students are saying about light rail.
Well,
Letty, let
me stop you right there. Chad Gibson, who's one of my guests here, is a lecturer at the Knowlton School of Architecture at Ohio State University, and he led a project recently with undergraduate students on along the same lines. Let me ask you, Letty, did that plan from the UC students, that business plan, did it include a public-private partnership?
I don't know.
Okay. All right. Well, we will check into that and look at it. Thank you so much for your call. Have you heard of it, Josh? Are you familiar with Cincinnati? Okay.
Not either,
right.
But I can tell you a lot of my students from around the country, they will not stay in Columbus because it lacks a fixed rail system to use. And I've been told that time and time again by a variety of students.
What do you hear, Josh?
Well, it's interesting. I also serve on the Create Columbus Commission.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, that's a young professionals commission. And again, a focus for them is transit because they know how important transit is to young professionals and to keeping young professionals in the city. So, yeah, it's the same response.
Greg Lawson of Buckeye Institute made the salient point, though, that that may be how millennials and young professionals feel now. But when their kids start growing up and that kind of a thing, they're going to change their tune.
Yeah, it's interesting. I live downtown in a new apartment building, and about half the people that live there are boomers. So this isn't just for millennials. This is for everyone.
Okay.
It's also about access for everyone. So you know, whether we don't want people to have to own a car to get to their job in Columbus. That's a huge expense. That's $10,000 a year. So if we can make jobs more accessible by building better transit, I think that benefits everyone, not just millennials and not just boomers, but mm-hmm. everyone in the city. Mm-hmm. And 30% of the people that live in Columbus don't have a car. So,
and I believe that many communities in Central Ohio are ratcheting up density in certain areas. Think about Dublin and their Bridge Street plan. Think about Upper Arlington and our Lane Avenue corridor. We're allowing more urban-style development, so more infill development. The city of Upper Arlington nearly had $100 million worth of construction last year. We're an inner-ring, landlocked suburb. That is a significant number, and I think you're going to continue to see that into the future. So the density is rising. And
yeah, they're doing the same thing in Worthington. I know they're rethinking what their role in that larger community is. And it's not just Columbus going high density. It's all the inner-ring ones as well. And Dublin, for that matter, is doing the same sort of thing. Email from Anya writes, I'm not sure people will use light rail if employers continue to provide ample parking. Instead of light rail, what about bus rapid transit, fixed bus routes, or why not light rail around 270 with bus circulars in the suburbs and in central Columbus? Josh Lapp, when you look at all the things you're talking about with your group, do those kind of scenarios arise?
Oh, absolutely. I think that light rail is just a piece of the answer to the question. So we are already building bus rapid transit. Maybe more will come. And again, it's a data-driven thing. So can we support light rail? We believe that we can. We believe that we'll show that. Can we support it everywhere? Probably not. So maybe bus rapid transit or circulators or other things can fill in the gaps.
And here's an email from Frankie, you know, speaking of Dublin, who writes, it is about time we get light rail. I would love rail to extend to suburbs. I live in Dublin. It can take 20 minutes just to get down Sawmill Road on a Saturday. It can take me an hour to get to campus and forget the bus lines. So that's Frankie in Dublin. And Mary Jo writes, a lot of the 500,000 new people in Central Ohio are currently arriving in the northwest of Columbus area as multifamily housing building is exploding. Many more will come to the 161 Bethel Road, Sawmill Road, and Riverside Drive under land use plans currently under development. Isn't this light rail idea premature in not considering this new growth? Josh Lapp?
No, actually, I think transit builds on growth. So, and all of transportation does. We built the interchange at Easton so that we could build Easton. We need to build light rail lines so that we can accommodate the 500,000 people that are coming to Columbus in the next, you know, 30 years.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the biggest deal is when a community gets its exit, you know, its exit off of the expressway now. That's where the first McDonald's goes up.
Yeah. And someday that's how it will be for light rail. I think once we have one line, communities around Central Ohio will be clamoring for more.
Josh Lapp, do you see it as an inevitability?
It seems like it is everywhere around the country, and I don't think that in Columbus we're going to be the ones. I don't think other cities are going to say, whew, we wish we were like Columbus and we did nothing, that we didn't invest in transit. Nobody's going to say that. So it seems like it has to be an inevitability if we actually are going to meet the desires and goals of the community.
And what's your sense about that, Chad Gibson?
Well, you think about the massive road construction projects that we have with the I-70-71 split. Think about the north side mega fix up at 23 and 315 and 270. There are going to be more of those that are going to be needed in the future.
And that's $2 billion.
Mm-hmm. That is. That's a significant sum. So we need to fix our problems proactively so that they're not more expensive down the road, which they will be.
Well, Chad Gibson, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
Chad Gibson, he's a lecturer in the Knowlton School of Architecture at OSU. He's also a senior planning officer for the city of Upper Arlington. And Josh Lapp, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Josh Lapp, he's vice chair of Transit Columbus, a proponent organization of more mass transit in the city besides bus. Thanks to all of the callers. Thanks to everyone who sent us an email. Appreciate your input. Thanks to the Allside staff, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurovich, assistant producer Shyla Knott, Allside's interns Summer Cartwright, Khalid Moalim, and Sydney Schaefer, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Alan DiCenzo, he's the composer of our theme music. Thanks again for listening. This is Allsides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.